Press that to start. Maybe I'll.
Morning, everyone. Carjul showed me how to record. And I think last year we recorded, and then Carjul's phone got stolen the next day. So I don't know if that's an omen.
But we're it's your phone this year. That's
okay. So, so today I want to share with you about justice, and even more importantly, wisdom, and how wisdom pertains to justice, and why and how mindfulness practice can actually help us maintain wisdom when we're really reaching for justice, and why justice without wisdom is really maybe not quite what it is that we want to do. The sutras, the teachings that we're recording, the teachings of the Buddha that were recorded, they do talk about justice in different parts, but they talk about wisdom even more. And so there's now some discussion up in the in different Buddhist spaces about which is more important, wisdom or justice. And I think it's an interesting thing. I've listened to some talks, I've read some pieces about it. I think it's really curious how we interpret justice out of the Buddhist philosophy. I'm also cautious about people interpreting justice out of the Buddhist philosophy without having some direct experience in injustice. Because I think it adds an even deeper level of understanding to what wisdom might need to look like in spaces of injustice in order to understand what that justice might look like. And I think in the West and in the East, we have also different concepts on understanding of what justice is. So all that is interesting words and meanings. But for me, what's most important is ethical practice in anything. So if we're pursuing justice as activists, how do we bring our ethical practice into the work that we're doing, whatever that work is? And for me, that cuts right through the words. The words are words. We make definitions and we develop concepts and theories. But with ethical practice, which is what mindfulness is, the words drop away, and then we can see really clearly in front of us what's the most skillful thing to do in any place or any situation. And then we can bring that understanding into the places of justice and injustice that we are participating in. So for me, this is what mindfulness is how do I bring an ethical framework into all the places that I say I want to transform? And those of us who are committed to the work of justice, and I use this word because that's what we all, when I say justice, we all kind of come together on one point, right? We're like, oh yeah, she's talking about this. And I think in this room, when I say that, most of us may come to that point. But I'm not even sure, right? Because we all come from different places and we all have different understanding from our own experiences of what justice might mean and look like for us. We might also have very different understandings of what injustice means and looks like. And some of us can be right in the middle of injustice and we can't identify as such. Practically, what does that mean? That we experience this every single day of our lives. Women and men in a space where a woman is being treated unfairly just because she's a woman, a man might not even know or recognize that. In that situation, there's two people who have two different understandings of what injustice is right then and there. It's just the nature of the experience. Person of color, a white person, happens all the time, every day in my life. In most people of color's life, we're in a situation with a person who's a white person, or identified as white, a situation of injustice comes up right there in the way I'm treated. Waiting at a counter to be served, and someone white comes up behind me, and the server just happens to see them and miss me, who've been standing there. That's a situation of injustice. That white person goes ahead and recognizes that they deserve to be served, even though I'm standing there. They didn't see that, they didn't call that as an injustice. Neither the server or the white person that came after me, right? That's, in my eyes, that's injustice. In that white person's eye, that's not injustice, right? And it goes on and on, right? So it's really this understanding of justice, I think if we wait to define it, and we wait for everyone to have the similar interpretation and definition of it, we might be waiting a whole long time, because we have been waiting a whole long time already, right? And look where we're at. You know, we're in some of the most distressing times on this earth. We've gone back to times of segregation that we thought we had left behind. So we still don't get it. We all still don't get an understanding of what justice might mean and what injustice might mean. So for me, I thought a lot about this. and I find it frustrating to think that I have to wait till everybody understands what justice means. So for me, what I've come to understand is, if we can all have an understanding of what ethical practice and skillfulness is, we will cut through the definitions of justice and injustice, and we'll act skillfully. And so what does that mean? Let's come back to the to me in the line, and a white person comes behind me. You walk up on anybody standing in front of you waiting to be served. It would just be the ethical, skillful thing to allow that person who's been waiting to be served, regardless of their skin color, regardless of whether they're male or female, regardless of whether they speak English or not, right? Regardless of whether they have an ability or a disability, regardless of whether they're a minor or a more elderly person, regardless of whether they look like they're an immigrant or not. Regardless of whether they look poor and they don't have the proper clothing on, it wouldn't matter, because the right thing to do, the more skillful thing to do, the ethical thing to do would be to allow the person who is in front of you to be served. That just be male and female in a room and offering suggestions in a classroom, in a boardroom, who gets listened to, usually who gets expected to have the answer, and then who then gets listened to, usually the male. The ethical thing to do from the male sitting next to that female would be to allow their female colleague to be listened to as well, and to offer the space for that person to be heard. That would be the ethical thing to do, regardless of who it was. It could be another male in the room. It wouldn't matter. It would be, the person would think everyone should have an equal opportunity to speak. But that requires that we are aware of ourselves. We're aware of where we feel inferior and where we feel superior, and why we need to feel superior to someone else in order to moves through the world. Because oftentimes when we take privilege on and act out of it, some of it is, you know, it's kind of generationally passed. This, we have social norms that say there's hierarchies based on race, class, gender, immigrant status, language, ability, sexual orientation, worship. So some of it's passed on to us, but the way we carry out that has a lot to do with how much we need feel that we need to feel better than someone else. And that's where our ego comes into play, right? If I feel that I can be better than someone else, it allows me to not worry about being the least one at the bottom. I remember this story a long time ago when I started doing anti-racism and anti-oppression work more than 20 years ago. One of the trainings was that there were folks interviewed working class white people in the Appalachians who we know are very poor, right? And I was a journalist doing some work on race and interviewing them about their state of life and how poor they had, how bad they had it, and no health care, no dental care, and all this. Very real things. And in the process of the interview, asked, don't you feel bad? Don't you feel this is the worst thing? Can there be anything worse? And the person said, no, because I'm still white. So I always remember that story, and I never understood it completely, but I understand it in a different way now. What I understand it is that we always think that we need to feel better than someone else. And where does that come from? So for me, the reason the practice for me is so deep and so revolutionary is that when I start feeling so at home and grounded in myself, I won't ever need to feel better than anyone else again, because I have it all right here. And at the bottom of all of this hierarchy, at the bottom of all this judgment, and the bottom of how we have developed separation around all the different issues, what it supports and what it nourishes is this need for us to feel better than someone else, because we are so unable to feel full in our own selves. And that's it. If we could just, that's it. It's as simple but as challenging as that, is when we reach the state where we are fully present and we, in any moment, we are able to feel sufficient as we are. That's when we start dropping all of the need to use the social norms to lift ourselves up and feel better than someone else. Because that's all it is. It's this caricature, it's this framework, all these social norms. They give us this ability to forget to take care of ourselves and to find ourselves. And as long as we have norms and social norms that are hierarchical, patriarchal, we will never need to do the work of finding the deepest strength inside of us. I say that for people who usually are in positions of power, because they are the ones mostly who have something to camouflage the lack of something else. Right? So why do the work? Because you've got this whole structure that will always protect your ego, never ever having to look beyond that. But I think what happens is those of us who are marginalized in many, many different ways, we don't have that structure to hold us up. And so what do? We look for it in here. this is my own personal experience. I have never touched freedom until I've started to find out how strong and how powerful I am inside. Because none of the norms give me, I don't have the frameworks to like scaffold myself on. So I have to do the work. It's the only way I can exist without feeling like everybody in this world is better than me. And that's useless. I've gone through, done that, been there. It's not nourishing. It's very painful. It's like, it's not why we're here either. I mean, we're here to be liberated. We're here to be fully everything that we are. And if I'm camouflaged and feeling inferior and feeling relative to every single person around me, how can I ever like fully blossom into everything that I am? And I will say that those who are camouflaged in the framework of the social norms also will never be able to blossom fully into who they are, because they're stuck in this caricature of what society has told them they are. And they just move through it like robots, taking on the privileges, exercising it, and never really discovering what else they are and who they are. And this is it. This is who we are. This is what this practice allows us, to break out of that, to break out of the caricature of the social norm that puts us into our locale and tells us to just robotically move through it, which is often what we do in this world, is we just move through that. That's the ghost that Karajul talked about this morning. That's the sleepwalking that we all do every single day. Until we start touching and finding out what else is there, what else is there besides what society tells me I am and how I should be and how I should treat people and who they are and who they are and who I am, right? Because without this exploration and without this ability to look and understand who we are, we're stuck in those caricatures. Right? We're nothing else but that. We're just shells, robots, asleep. So for those of us who believe in justice, who believe in the idea and the practice of being authentically present in the world, then we all need to wake up. And I would challenge us even further that activists, those who call ourselves activists, and I don't care what kind of activism we're involved in, that it is imperative that we wake up. Because we say we're doing the work of justice. We say we're radical revolutionaries. But there is nothing radical about sleepwalking. And I don't care if you're on the front lines with the Black Lives Matter movement, but if you're still asleep, that is not radical. That is just being a clone of the system that holds onto the caricature of what they say you are at a protest. That's all it is. And the victory that comes out of that one thing is very limited. It ends right after that thing. Why? Because there hasn't been any personal transformation. We're still just carrying it out in that same caricature of who I am as this person. Oh yeah, I support the Black Lives Matter movement. But the internal transformation hasn't happened. And that goes for the same thing with every Black person or brown person who's also carrying it. If the internal transformation hasn't happened in us, we also are just caricatures. And the wins are also limited to just that thing that we just struggled for, that piece of legislation that we just got passed, that homeless shelter that we got some funding to start up. It's just that. It's good, it's beautiful, but it's also what we've been doing for quite a long time. And it's why we're still in the 21st century in the place that we're still at. So that sounds like a really challenging picture I just offered. And yet, I think if you're willing to come and spend a whole weekend at a retreat, then we really have to look deeply into what it is that we say our activism is about. What is justice about? And how are we going to be different in it? And this retreat and this practice that we're cultivating and co-creating and learning and together is about how are we going to understand this practice of mindfulness as a liberating tool, as a skillful means to keep waking up over and over again, to bring that awake self, that you know, staying woke self into every single space that we're inhabiting in our activism struggle and in our struggles of justice. And that's what we're about. That's what we want to plant seeds and water seeds and grow big, beautiful palm trees, with coconuts, mangoes, pineapple, apples too. But that's what this practice is about. And so what I want to do is try to connect why I not just think, but how for me mindfulness has really like just revolutionized the way that I understand we're going to have justice. And how I find and I feel that if we don't bring an ethical base into our justice struggles, then we're really just replicating what's been happening for the last thousands of years. And that's what this daily practice is about, you know. So what has sitting there chewing my raisin in my raisin bran got to do with justice? Anybody? Right. One reason at a time, one step at a time, one breath at a time, one brushing your teeth at a time. Roll it, I was going to say rolling the window down. I mean, pressing the button so the window can come down at a time. Right? That's it. That's really it. It's this coming to know intimately and so, I guess the word intimate is as close as we can get, but it's not even close, it's inside. You know, the four foundations of mindfulness, which is one of the very important sutras of the Buddha, lays out this framework of how we are to understand the world into four phenomena, if you will. And it's a teaching on the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of phenomena, everything. These are the four ways that the Buddha sort of characterized all our existence, all of our experiences. And that is not something that we can take on in 35 minutes, but it's such an important sutra and something I think that we all might want to think of studying and practicing, but that any one of having a deep understanding and a practice of any one of those foundations would help us to get so intimate and so inside of our experience that anything we do, we have that level of discernment. Anything we do. Now just imagine that. That discernment that we have, that we've cultivated from knowing that raisin, the body in the body, the raisin in the raisin. It's not separate. It's not just an observation of the raisin anymore. It's I am so intimately knowing this raisin from the inside out. And the only way I can know that is because I have experienced it. I've not just read about it. I've not listened to a teaching about it. I've experienced it from the inside out, knowing the body in the body. Ardent, resolute. I mean, we're focused, we're one-pointed. And while we're one-pointed on that, we're also having this awareness around, all-around awareness. So this is not, you know, mindfulness, this is not easy stuff. This is a cultivation. This is like bringing everything to bear on a different way of being in the world. It rivals everything. You know, it requires such precision on a point, and also an ability to keep in mind everything else that is going on around us. It's a training of the mind that we don't usually do. And the way that this Buddha guy said we could learn it is by just starting with these daily mundane things like we're trying to do here. How do we get so intimately close and inside every experience that we're having that it becomes second nature? And we do it in retreats. It's like planting the seeds, right? We come to retreats, we drop the world distractions, we surround ourselves with others who have that same energy and mind so we can bring and support that energy. And we hold each other. We hold the energy together. We are now like putting this beautiful protection around our practice space. And all the impingements of the world that we usually face in our daily lives, especially in cities, we're dropping those away, dropping those away. We come out to nature because nature brings itself a different way of being that drops, helps to buffer and drop and heal. And then we point our mind in this direction of getting so intimate with all the experiences that we have. And the seed is planted, and just like a seedling, it starts to take root right here this weekend. And then when we leave, we find places to continue to practice with each other, with others who are practicing elsewhere, and we keep watering that seed that was sprouted. And just like that, until before we know it, we're in a situation where someone's yelling at us, someone's saying something mean to someone in front of us, and without even know it, you can see it all in front of you, all play out like a movie that stopped. You can see all the frames. And it's as if time stops, and you can see it all. And in that clarity, you make a different decision than you would have made were you not able to see all those frames of reference. So the mindfulness brings the concentration that Karajul spoke about this morning, and the insight that makes us choose maybe a little differently than if we didn't have that clarity, that observation that allowed us the distance to see without being pulled in. Right? So because we're practicing this mindfulness, we're able to start observing things minute by minute. We're seeing more clearly. And more importantly, we're not getting pulled into it by the old knee-jerk reactions when our buttons get pressed. Instead of it pressing on us responding and jumping in, we don't even jump in, we're pulled in. We have no control. We're like completely out of control. We don't even know. We think we're so smart. But every interaction we have, we're like little puppets. We just like drop into it. But we think we have control. But really we don't. But this practice of observation, in that moment we're seeing things. Now it's almost like I'm not in it anymore. I'm seeing it. I have some distance. And that distance allows a different process of decision making. This is the discernment. This is the insight. And we make a different decision. And we choose differently. And what does that look like? That looks like maybe not saying something that you're going to regret in about as soon as it comes out your mouth. Maybe that in a situation where you're negotiating. Maybe that means you make a different decision that doesn't end up in a war. And that's how deep this is. We talk about peace, but we don't even have the spaciousness to be able to touch peace when we're in the midst of violence. How can we ever make that grow into some peaceful movement building? If even in an interaction with a personal friend, we're not able to de-escalate and offer peace right then, how could we ever bring it into our movement? How can we, when we can't even practice it one-on-one? So this practice of mindfulness, it allows us all this. It allows us this clarity. It allows us this distance for observation. This clear thinking allows us to see everything that's around us. We see under what is just there. We see things that other people who are not practitioners do not see. And we hear things that others don't hear, because what we hear is what's not being said. And that becomes part of what helps us make a better decision. So these are practices that help us in our daily life with our significant others, with our families and friends, in our spaces in workplaces, in our schools. And even more importantly, these are practices that help us to be activists of change that are so radical. We have gone beyond violence as a tactic for change, which I think in many of our movement strategies, violence is a tactic. We don't say that, but we practice like that. So I see practice of mindfulness as one that I see this as within the activist space. I've been trying to really like map out what are the steps, like how do we translate mindfulness into spaces of activism and organizers? How do we bring it out so that anybody can understand, hey, this might be something that I might want to look into. So I've mapped it out into three parts. They're not separate, but you know, the linear mind likes to have little fragments so that it can tuck them away. And that's all right. And I like to offer three examples as how, for me, I see it playing out. So if I was drawing, there would be like, the one smiley face, that's the individual person, right? That's the practice where you're invited to look into yourself. That's the practice where you're invited to notice when you're brushing your teeth, when you're eating, when you're stepping. That's the personal practice, the practice of becoming aware of me, knowing me, understanding me. I had this insight the other day. I don't know where I was. I think I was on the plane. And I realized, I thought, wow, I don't even know myself. And then the most scary thought came, which was, wow, I don't even know anybody. And then, is it 11 already? Wow. Okay. So, just to finish that thought, what made sense to me then was, in a time and place where we're othering, because I think right now we're in this, like, we're in the time and space of othering, it's easy to other others when I don't know myself. It makes it so much easier to drop anybody. I can drop any one of you right now into the other category. And that becomes easy because I don't even know me. So how can I even continue to think I know you? And so immediately you're in the other space. But so am I. I'm in that space too. So I want to close with the smiley. So the individual smiley is the interpersonal. That's what this work is. The thought of why there's a, again, you know, this weekend is the ceasefire, second Baltimore ceasefire. Why aren't we there at the Baltimore ceasefire, right? Well, we're cultivating the first smiley face. We're cultivating the other, no, the non-othering, so I can know myself. And it requires time. It's something we don't give ourselves. It's the stillness, it's the stopping. Then there's a second, and so how did that come? So that for me was recently in a negotiation with people we're trying to buy a hall from, listening to these white men lie, who are in positions of power. Like, how was I able to take care of myself and not really go off on them when I could see exactly what they were doing? I could see so clearly because I had the distance. I could see them in a way that they couldn't see themselves. And so what did I do with that? Well, my practice allowed me to see it and then to decide how I would act. So it doesn't mean we don't act. It means we see and we make a decision as to how we're going to act. So mindfulness is not about turning the other cheek and walking away. It's about being present to know when to turn the other cheek and when to stay and do something. But that comes only from the personal practice, right? The second smiley face is like, I see like a circle of smiley faces. And that's our organizational smiley, or people, right? Where how do we act in our activist organization with each other, right? How do we bring our ethical practice into organization so that the means that Karajul talked about is we're practicing justice as we are also acting for justice, right? So I'm on the hiring committee for the Black Workers Center, and we had this wonderful discussion of how are we as a people hiring staff, how are we going to act, how are we going to be to fulfill and act the purpose of what the Black Workers Center is, and how do we bring that and offer that to the people we're hiring as organizers so they understand that if they're joining the Black Workers Center, they have to bring that ethic already. So how do we come out of that ethical practice? And again, it takes, like Harjo said this morning, it takes really one person that's really steady and solid to plant the seed and to say, if we're doing it ethically, then we have to come back to this. And to be so solid that it has an effect. And so that happened, right? Like it stopped, and we took the time to really say, okay, this is what it means to be ethical in a process of practice, of hiring people to be in the center. But it was real. If I didn't have the practice, I wouldn't have been able to be steady to offer that out. So we bring what we are into spaces, right? And so the larger space is when we bring it out into the world, in our movement building, in the spaces where we're negotiating with people unknown, who we don't know, who we'll never see again, who don't like us, right? Because that's often where we are in spaces. And this one just happened Wednesday. Perkins Home, some of you might know, public housing, 680 units, they're getting privatized. That means potentially 680 families can be displaced. I was at a public meeting where the city is presenting the plan for displacement, because it's real. And got into this back and forth with the person presenting the information, and to the point where she wouldn't answer my questions. And I stopped and I thought, this woman doesn't like me. Why is she? And I thought it was just me, so I just shut up. And then this lady, who I don't know, one of the residents of the housing, said, she said, "Why aren't you answering that lady's questions? You ignore her, you cut her off. I don't know if you two have something, but why are you so rude to her?" And I thought, wow, it was really, it wasn't me, it was her. But the reason I had to stop was I've been in situations where it was me, right? Like where I was the one, like, but that, bringing that into a space where even when someone is going at you, to be able to really just sit down and shut up. Because sometimes you just have to sit down and shut up. It's just the way it is. But I think when you do that, people see, because the people are noticing. And so people come back in to help you. I mean, there's more to say, but I think I just wanted to bring the practice front and center in the middle of spaces where we do this work. Those are just three examples. But for me, this is my practice. It's trying to remember in every situation how to walk this talk here. If not, I don't deserve to be here to talk with you. And I want us to all be able to do that. I want us to all walk the talk together, hold each other accountable, come back to the practice. There's no mindfulness police, and there's no justice police. But we don't need that if we have each other, to just put our hands on each other's shoulder and remind each other that we trust that we're in this for the long haul, that we want liberation, we want love, and we want healing. Because this is really what justice should be about. This is the wisdom of justice that sometimes we lose touch with. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes.
Sound of a small bell, we can massage our legs.